For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm Red Sale.
I'm Robert Kirkwood.
And coming up today, Lee Child,
Jessica Townsend,
Alistair Petrie and Lucy Scott,
Natalie Haynes,
John le Carré,
and Red Sale himself. All that and more coming up on today's Read On. Now, episode 281 of Read On. Red, why is this one a momentous show?
Well, after nearly 6 years in the presenter's chair, I'm heading off to pastures new.
No!
I'm afraid so, but fear not, Read On will remain in very safe hands. In fact, Robert, it's a momentous day for you too.
Yeah, I'm back in the presenter's chair after having a rest for 6 years. The history of Read On is it came out of Talking Books, the show on RNIB Connect Radio. There used to be a Talking Books special every now and again that I really enjoyed making, so I made more of them. It became its own show. It became Read On. And then at a book festival I covered for RNIB Connect Radio and the Read On show, I met this guy who'd written a book about being a mountaineer. Shall we have a listen to some of that?
Yeah. Roll back the years.
I was lucky that until about 35, I could still read a book with strong light and reading glasses. But when that started going, I just got very depressed. Partly I solved it by starting to write myself. So in some ways it freed that genie from the bottle. But as any writer will tell you, you can't write unless you read. You have to read other people's work. And Talking Books has been a lifeline for me. My life would not be half as pleasurable without Talking Books. And there's a wonderful library of pretty much anything you could want to read. And the fact that you can also request that books are recorded is just terrific. So I'm gonna sound a little bit like a heavy drinker here. You know, I'm on two books a week. And if there was just more time in my life, I would be on more. Being able to sort of cart my daisy machine around the house and do the cooking, do the ironing, feed the cat whilst listening to a daisy is just perfect. So thank you, RNIB, for the Talking Books.
What sort of books do you listen to?
It's a bit of anything and everything. I'm addicted to crime fiction. I write crime fiction myself. So, and I love the golden age of crime books. So Marjorie Allingham, Dorothy L. Sayers, Agatha Christie. Equally, I love the Shardlake books, which are, you know, have been written more recently. But I listen to mountaineering books. There's a fine selection of Chris Bonington books to listen to. I listen to biographies. All those books that I should have read at university and never did because I spent too much time having fun. So, you know, I've gone back and filled in the holes in the sort of, you know, Dickens and Jane Austen that I only ever read criticism books about. But there's just such a wide range. And every so often, I don't know whether I'm you know, it's only me, but every so often either I order something that I must have mistaken for something else, or there's a glitch and I'll just get something totally and utterly out of the blue. And I'll be listening to, you know, the biography of some poor woman who grew up in the, you know, in the rough end of Glasgow and had some awful wasting disease, and I'll think, I would never have picked that up. And suddenly I would just find that I'm loving it, and I've had an insight into somebody else's life that I would never have had otherwise. So there's always something there. I so look forward to those little CD packages coming through my letterbox.
That was me interviewing you, Red Sale, for the very first time at the Wigtown Book Festival.
A younger, fitter me.
And me. Definitely. That was the very first time we'd met. Not the last time we'd be at a book festival together, but it certainly was the very first time. And after that, we sort of got to know each other, and eventually you became an RNIB employee and took over the reins of Read On in the presenter's chair.
Yeah, that's gratitude for you, isn't it? You introduced me to R&IB and I steal your chair.
Well, we were co-presenters for a long time, right up, I mean, what, 4 or 5 years until I broke my leg and had to go away for a wee while when I was... I spent 3 months on the couch and you and Hannah did a tremendous job of presenting and producing Read On.
Yeah, it certainly taught me how to use the editing software and put in those music beds. And who'd have thought that the man who enjoys dangerous sports would not be the one to break his leg, Robert?
Yeah, well, as I said, I've been a skier and snowboarder for years and I tripped over a rug.
Most accidents happen at home. And it has to be said, it's one of those things that I've really, really enjoyed about Read On. Just hearing people's stories and realising that actually quite often truth is stranger than fiction.
Well, you're stepping away from the presenter's chair and away from R&IB, but you're not stepping away from Read On. You'll still pop up every now and again with an interview. But let's take this show to have a listen back to some of your favourite interviews. And what one would you like to play first?
Well, yeah, the great thing about this job is it gives you a calling card to go to authors and publishers who you love and just ask them if they'd like to come on and tell their stories to a wider audience and an audience that enjoys specifically often their audiobook versions. So I've always been a bit of a Jack Reacher fan. And so the opportunity to interview Lee Child came up. I told him that the Jack Reacher books are hugely popular amongst people who use the R&IB Talking Books library. And he jumped at the chance. And in the course of the interview, he told me some amazing things, such as where Jack Reacher's name came from, and the fact that there's a bunch of blind veterans in the US who share the Jack Reacher stories in a rather special way.
One thing that I know some crime writers have an issue with, especially if you're writing a third person narrative, is sometimes the narrator can give away the otherwise hidden killer by using that voice a little bit too early on when the killer is planning a crime. Do you ever now write with that in mind?
Well, you know, to be honest, I always have, because quite apart from the utility convenience of audio, which is huge, you know, not just for people that are visually challenged, but for people with long commutes, people who like to listen while they're doing the dishes, audio is a huge thing. And I believe that is for a very deeply rooted reason, which is that human beings have been evolving for millions of years. And we got language along the way fairly recently in terms of that span. And we began to tell stories. So in terms of the human psyche, you know, what is deeply baked into our brains, maybe for 100,000 years, storytelling has been oral. You sit and listen to it. The bestseller guy of his day was the guy who had 20 people sitting in his cave listening rather than 10 people. Narrative has been audio for so long, and it's been written down on a page for so short. Regular people like me have been reading off a page for about 150 years, maybe a little longer, since mid or late 19th century, regular people learn to read. So reading off a printed page is a very new thing, and I think will probably be a temporary thing. I think the way technology is now, the way that people are so happy and familiar with downloading and digital files and things like that, I think we are going to see long-form narrative return to audio within, I don't know, 10 or 20 years.
And as far as the future for Jack Reacher is concerned, the latest book, Past Tense, has taken him to the New Hampshire town where his father was born and brought up. He's revisiting his past, but where does he go from here? How much longer can he carry on going?
Well, that is a great question. And it is in a way, not up to me to say how much longer he can go on. It's really up to the reader. How long does the reader want him? And I'm sure they'll let me know when they've had enough, and I'll find out from the market in general. So I really don't know. In an existential way, I'm kind of concerned about that old showbiz maxim: get off the stage and leave them wanting more. Do not be the embarrassing guy that sticks around a few years too long and is remembered for the last few really terrible books rather than the earlier good books. So it's a strategic decision that I'll have to make at some time.
Well, I'm certainly hoping that he's got a few more cases in him. I'm hoping that you're going to bring him back to the UK and maybe a blind character or two somewhere in the future.
Yeah, that would be a great idea. I've actually known quite a few blind people, and what a fascinating life it is. You know, obviously very hard, but to be deprived of one of the senses and to make a success of your life is a hell of a thing. Years ago, I was contacted by a small organization. There's only like 200 members. They are ex-Marine Corps radio operators who have gone blind later in life. And they don't use audiobooks. They use Morse code. And so there's this service that we send a plain text file of the book, and somebody has a computer program that then turns that into Morse code. And around the country, 200 retired Marine Corps radio operators listen to the books on Morse code, which I think is extraordinary.
That really is an example of adaptability, isn't it?
It sure is. And, you know, there's no punctuation in Morse code, so it must be really hard.
You can't nod out for a moment. You'd miss an entire page of action.
Yeah, you would, yeah.
Well, I'll drink to that. Lee Child, thank you so much for discussing Jack Reacher with us and for all the entertainment that you have given to me and millions of other readers.
Well, thank you very much for that. And thanks to all the readers, and thanks to the listeners who may be readers. Certainly they're readers of somebody, and that is great with me. I love a book. Listen to a book. You've got the whole world in your hand right there. You can live anywhere at any time. It's one of the greatest transformational things. And the fact that you can get that for a few quid is just amazing.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Red, it's your last day in the presenting chair. So what interview would you like to share next?
Well, it's not just well-established authors who we get to talk to on this brilliant show. Every so often you get given a book that you just know is going to become immensely popular and that you just want to recommend to everybody. And that happened with an author called Jessica Townsend, a young Australian author who, you know, clearly had absolutely adored the Harry Potter books when she was a youngster. And when she moved from the east coast of Australia, where she'd been working in a kind of crocodile wildlife centre, she came to London and fell in love with the London Underground. And this gave her an entry into creating this amazing world of Nevermore. And the series is now three or four books old. But she just came into the studio and exploded with energy and enthusiasm and introduced us to the world of this young cursed child called Morrigan Crow and all the weird and wonderful things that happen to her when she gets picked out to join a very special academy.
Let's have a listen.
Jess Townsend, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, tell us a little bit more about the world of Nevermore.
So, Nevermore is an imaginary place. It's a place made up. It's sort of inspired by London, inspired a lot by my time in London. And the book Nevermore is about a little girl called Morrigan Crow, who is cursed. So she's born on the wrong day, the unluckiest day, a day called Eventide. And because of this day that she's born, she gets blamed for everything that goes wrong in her world. So there's a little boy who loses a spelling competition and she gets the blame, and someone has a heart attack and she gets the blame, and a school burns down and she gets the blame for that too. So Nevermore furthermore, the other side of this curse is that Morrigan also knows when she's going to die. So she's supposed to die on her next birthday, but instead she gets rescued and sort of spirited away into this secret magical city called Nevermore. And she's been invited to stay with this strange person in a magical hotel and compete against hundreds of other children to join the Wondrous Society. And she has to have a talent. So all of these hundreds of kids, they all have some kind of talent or a knack for something that is supposed to get them into the Wondrous Society. But the catch is that Morrigan doesn't have one, and she needs to get into the society if she's going to be allowed to stay.
And the wonderful, rather dandyish figure who rescues her is called Jupiter North, who who reminded me of all those wonderful characters like Bertie Wooster or so on and so forth. But he's just like Bertie Wooster. He, underneath, he's actually a lot smarter than the clothing might make him appear.
Right. I think he comes, and he probably likes coming across as quite silly and not a particularly good adult. I think he is sort of a composite of, you know, all of those characters like Bertie Wooster that I sort of grew up, you know, I grew up watching British television and reading British books, so he's very much influenced by that. But yeah, he is a terrible adult, but in some ways he has his moments. He's quite wise and sort of funny.
And it's a wonderfully fun story. I mean, you clearly have really enjoyed writing it and soaked up, well, I guess, everything you've ever read or experienced. It was about 10 years in the making.
Yeah, it took quite a long time. And I mean, it's that sort of, you know, that side of, you know, really enjoying what I was writing and having fun. Honestly, that's the only reason that I think I finished it, because I'm such a procrastinator, like probably every other writer in the world. And, you know, this is the first book that I've written. It's the first kind of whole story that I've completed, and it did take a long time. But, you know, it's a result of writing the book that I just desperately wanted to read, and every kind of shiny new idea that I had that could have gone on and been a story in its own right, I just sort of thought, well, I'll just put it in Nevermore. It became a bit of a kitchen sink novel in that way.
And I read somewhere that actually Nevermore spun out from another story that you were writing beforehand.
Right. So way, way, way back in the beginning, I started, I'm not even sure if I started sort of writing much of it. I might have written a few pages, but I was plotting a story about a little girl who went to live with her eccentric aunt Morrigan. And her aunt Morrigan was this brave woman who was quite sharp and quite funny and interesting and eccentric. And I started, as I was writing that story, I started realizing that the protagonist, this little girl, was quite boring. And her aunt was the far more interesting. Her aunt and her aunt's best friend, Hawthorne, were the far more interesting people. And I just sort of dialed that back and started thinking about, well, what was she like when she was a little girl? Where did she come from? What happened to her in her childhood that made her so brave and so funny and interesting?
You started writing this, I think I read, when you just finished high school.
Mm.
And whilst you were working at Australia Zoo, were there squeezy crocodiles?
Unlikely but true, yes. Yeah, so that was my first job straight out of high school. You can clearly hear that I talk funny. I am Australian. I live on the from the Sunshine Coast, which is about 20 minutes from Steve Owen's zoo. And it was my first job out of high school. I was working in a shop, folding T-shirts, selling squeezy crocodiles. And I ended up doing a bunch of other different jobs there. I spent about 5 years there. It's the sort of place where if you kind of just muck in and prove that you can, that you're willing to try and willing to work hard, then they'll kind of let you do anything. So weirdly, at the end of that time, I was editing a children's wildlife magazine, which was quite fun.
Jessica Townsend telling Red Sail all about Nevermore. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, we can't stress the importance of pairing a great book with a great narrator.
And every so often, those narrators come in pairs. Alistair Petrie, who is a well-known screen actor, but absolutely brilliant narrator as well, is married to, I think, one of the best female narrators in the business, Lucy Scott, who has brought to life books such as Pride and Prejudice and many, many more modern titles as well. And as I say, they're a couple, and At one point during lockdown, they were pretty much keeping the Talking Books recordings afloat by themselves from a homemade studio, just showing how dedicated our narrators really are. Lucy Scott and Alistair Petrie, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So I understand that you've been busily promoting our new RNIB online library.
Yeah, it's such an amazing resource. What's really struck me recently with the circumstances we find ourselves in is the access and the need that we really have at the moment for stories. And I've thought a lot about this over the last sort of few weeks, that, you know, it's a confusing time, this whole sort of COVID-19 that everyone is going through. And having access to stories and a plentiful amount of stories is also very important, stories being so crucial to our lives. And how stories sort of help us understand the world in which we live, to make sense of the world in which we live. And I think we could all argue quite merrily at the moment that the world in which we find ourselves living is so extraordinary and so confusing, and there's a lot coming at us. And I think it gives us huge amounts of comfort as well. It gives us time away from our own thought processes, which is, I think, incredibly healthy. It feeds into our imaginations, and all of these things are in existence throughout our normal lives and in our very abnormal lives, which we're finding ourselves at the moment. It's never been more important, that access to stories.
One of the books that I've gone back to, which actually you narrated, is Touching the Void by Joe Simpson, which tells the story of his horrendous climbing accident and how he survived it. A chapter that really resonated with me was Set Achievable Targets, which has reminded me that we need to think of lockdown on a day-to-day basis rather than, oh, this could go on for months.
I think that's exactly right. I think if you try and see it and understand it as a whole, one is doomed to failure. I think accepting it day by day, trying to disseminate information, not to get too overwhelmed by that information, is so true. What's so extraordinary about that book, and a lot of books that I've always been rather attracted to when I've read them and or narrated them, is these human tales of endeavor and sort of how the human psyche works in those terms. And I think it's absolutely distilling it down to bite-sized chunks. And I've said this to my son several times when it comes to simple things in terms of their GCSE period last year, the 6 weeks of that. If you try and see it as a whole, then it'll become overwhelming and emotionally overwhelming. So yes, break it down into its constituent parts. And if you can do that, you can sort of navigate a way through it. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that is a really useful and applicable comparison to where we find ourselves in the world at the moment. Very much so.
Now, you've read a few dozen titles in the RNIB Talking Books library. However, Lucy Scott, you have read over 100, I found out.
Maybe not at all. I've read many more than that. Yes, I've been reading for the RNIB for over 20 years. I love it. I love going there. And I've learned so much from reading with you. My very first book was a children's book, and you were based at Great Portland Street. That's where the studios were. And I remember having prepared it, and I got very excited about it, and I bowled in there with all these explosions of accents and massive colour, and it was just too much. And one of the engineers, he was called Peter, he said, oh, you need to just wind that in, just dial it back, because it's just too much. It all becomes a story about accents. Just forget it. You need to give little flavours and allow the story to take over. And that was a really important lesson. Hand the story over and don't sort of cover it in all of your ego.
There was an upside to that, though. I remember when Lucy started reading for the RNIB, and the enthusiasm with which Lucy came home, which is a wonderfully default position for Lucy, but she came home and was talking all about it, not only the sort of skills required and the sort of creative endeavour that was reading, but also the atmosphere working alongside the RNIB at the studios was so uplifting that she said, you've got to get involved. So I was very lucky that I think Lucy sort of nudged and cajoled various people into saying, well, would you listen to his voice and see if it might be appropriate for you? So it's entirely thanks to Lucy that I ever started to build a relationship with the RNIB. For that, I'm eternally grateful, amongst many other things.
Alistair Petrie and Lucy Scott, and I was jealous of that one because Alistair Petrie's got a huge role in Star Wars Rogue One.
Absolutely. He's quite a character. And I just love that expression that Lucy came up with, that being a talking book's narrator is theatre for one. She's that whole ensemble cast just acting for us, the reader, the listener. And yeah, I think of all the things that happened during lockdown, that conversation was probably my favourite 45 minutes.
But it doesn't always go right.
No, it certainly doesn't, Robert. And you were with me actually holding the offending article when it went rather badly wrong at Wigtown.
Oh, so you're blaming me?
Oh, well. No, I'm blaming the fact that I didn't check the batteries in the MP3 recorder. We had just listened to a brilliant talk by the author and radio presenter Natalie Haynes, in which she summed up Homer's Iliad in 20 minutes, I think. And she very kindly held back her taxi to rush off to the station to give us a quick interview outside the tent. And it was a brilliant interview. It was in the sunshine. She was really on form. And then just at the end, she said, oh, should that light be flashing? And what happened next?
Yeah, we lost the entire interview.
And over a pint later, you and I held our heads in our hands and went, oh, goodness, what are we going to do? And I wrote a rather grovelling email to Natalie, who is a lovely, lovely person, and popped into the R&IB Talking Book Studios in Camden the next week, not just to re-record the interview, but actually to give a far more in-depth interview about her love of classics and how the blind poet Homer saw disability in the 5th century BC. I've always been struck by how blindness is treated in a very balanced way in Greek tragedy. It's not just punishment. It also can give insight.
Yes, it's a really interesting phenomenon, blindness, and particularly in the Oedipal story, because there is, of course, the most famous scene probably to us in Greek tragedy in that play, the Sophocles play Oedipus Tyrannus, Oedipus the King, when Oedipus finally realises who he is, that he is the man who has killed the previous king of Thebes, that in so doing he has killed unknowingly his father and he has unknowingly married his own mother. And at that realisation, he is so appalled by what he sees that he has become, and he can no longer bear to see it, not to understand it, but to see it. And so famously he takes the brooch pins from his hanged wife's dress and puts out his own eyes, so he ends the play blind. And it is the great irony of the play that only when he is blind does he truly see who he is and what he's done, and that when he finally sees that, he can no longer bear to see the light. And so there's certainly a sense of blindness there as a punishment. But it's a fascinating interplay of power, because there is a much more potent sense, I think, that only at the point when he is blind is Oedipus, for want of a better phrase, fully rounded and aware man, because up to that point he's been living a lie. And what's interesting, of course, is that in a later play, Oedipus at Colonus, he has become this man whose death is a benediction. Mm. And what an extraordinary turnaround. I once tried to sell a book called Oedipus Died Happy, and I'm afraid I could never persuade anyone to buy it, about the idea that you could actually find lessons for your life to be sort of better by reading Greek tragedy. And I still vaguely think I should revive it as an idea. And of course, running through the Oedipus story is also Tiresias, the blind prophet, the man who can never see but can always see everything. And he is always guided by a child. And so this sense that being able to see with eyes is at most part of the story, and sometimes it's actually obstructive to be able to see the truth, be able to understand the truth. That runs all the way through Greek myth.
Yeah. The blind seer.
It's almost
it's a contradiction in terms.
I know, and I don't even hear that. You know, when I read it or say it, I don't hear the contradiction there at all, because I'm so used to the idea of a seer being blind, which I know is crazy. But I think that's, again, that's one of those examples of Greek myth where it just seems so right. I was thinking this when the James Bond trailer came out, and it's like, oh, are you telling me the person's evil because they're facially disfigured? Again, the James Bond universe. What an interesting departure for you. And I thought, how interesting that Greek tragedy doesn't have that correlation at all. That, you know, Philoctetes isn't evil because he's got a bad foot. He's got a bad foot and it makes him bad tempered. So, but we understand that. And Tiresias, he's opaque because he chooses to be. It's not because he can't be, you know, so he can see, but he won't always share. And so he does have an insight that the rest of us can't always access.
And famously, Homer was supposedly blind as well.
Perhaps, yeah. The Odyssey is full of bards. And one of the things I love about the Odyssey, actually, is that it's full of rhapsode or bards who basically go around kind of being treated really well or really badly. And you kind of get the sense that the composer of the Odyssey is going, hey, guys, I would like some extra wine and meat if that's all right. And so look at how nicely this character is behaving with extra wine and meat for the rhapsode. But there's a bard in the Odyssey called, I think, Demodocus. There are a bunch. And Demodocus, I think, is blind. And so there's a suggestion that this is sort of an authorial trick, that it's Homer referring to himself. In my book, I made Homer blind, but I don't name him because it was a little hat tip to the fact that in the first line of the Iliad, he doesn't name the goddess, the muse. So I thought, this will be adorable. I'll have Homer, but I won't ever say that it's Homer. But I think probably most people haven't noticed. So another of my in-jokes goes famously flat.
You narrated the audiobook version yourself. Was that fun?
It was, actually. And I'd always said no to it before. This is the first of them I'd done. And they asked me if I would do The Children of Jocasta a couple of years ago. And I said no, because that has two narrative strands. One is third person, Jocasta, which I felt I probably could do. And the other is first person, is Mani. And she's sort of 14, 15. And I was like, dude, it's sweet of you to ask, but I'm 200 years old. I can't sound like a teenager. But with Ships, A Thousand Ships has so many different characters, multiple narrators. And so I thought, well, that's okay. Nobody can do it in a way. Nobody's got the right age voice for all of those women. And so I might as well do it as anyone else. So yeah, it was an incredibly... I don't normally read things once I've finished them. I read them the whole time I'm writing them. I read them aloud. I read them the whole time I'm editing aloud. I think the sound of sentences is something... I was astonished to find out everyone didn't do it. You know, it's one of those things where you sort of casually say in a group of writers and everyone looks at you like you've fallen from a tree and you're like, why isn't everyone doing this? It really helps. You know, you can put as many subordinate clauses in a sentence if you want, but if you can't say it, mate, how is anyone else ever going to? I don't know. It was such an emotional book to write, because some of it is lots of fun and some of it was incredibly harrowing. Actually, the most upsetting bit for me is the Andromache bit of the Trojan Women chapter, but I won't give it away because I don't want to make everyone else sad. And I cried when I wrote it, and I cried when I edited it, and I cried when I read it. And I thought they would make me retake it. And they were like, no, it's fine, it's good. And I was like, okay. And when I was writing it, it felt like it would, you know, fall over and topple over onto me and crush me. And then when you actually come to it, it's like two pages or something. I was like, how is it possible this huge thing can be so tiny? But anyway.
The stories are originally from an oral tradition.
Yes.
So I suppose, actually, you're returning to the source in that respect.
Absolutely, yeah, why not? And that's why I like having a live show that kind of goes with the book. And the live show generally is fun, like the radio shows are. Well, at least they're intended to be. I was like, the books usually are more serious and more sad. So, yeah, I like the idea of performing around the book.
What was the first text that opened your eyes to the classics?
It's probably the Aeneid, actually. It's probably a Roman text, because I had Aeneid 2 at GCSE, which is the Fall of Troy. That's the Creusa chapter of my book. And it is such a remarkable book of poetry, because it's sort of, it's the great action movie sequence, the city on fire, man trying to escape with his child and his wife disappears, and it's you know, thrilling. And also Creusa gets nothing to do apart from be a ghost. And so I was determined, even I think at 15, I guess I must have been when I read that, I thought, well, this isn't acceptable. This woman's story needs to be told.
Natalie Haynes in the RNIB Talking Book Studios for her second interview, as the first one broke. In fact, that happened with Bill Bryson as well. Bill Bryson was a big interview. I recorded about a good 45 minutes with him. He was in the RNIB Talking Book Studios, so we were connected down the line from Glasgow to London, as we are just now. But I ended the interview, I hit save, and halfway through it, the little bar going down, the lights flickered. I thought the worst, and sure enough, half of the interview was missing. It was lost to the ether. The computer had crashed halfway through, or a power cut happened halfway through it being saved. Fortunately enough, because he's such a nice guy, I wrote an email to the person who was working with him at the R&B Talking Book Studios, and he stayed back the next night and gave the second half of the interview once again. You can find that interview online if you just type in Bill Bryson, R&B. Now, talking of big interviews that you loved, what's the last one on today's show?
Well, I couldn't leave without replaying at least part of the wonderful interview that I was very, very lucky to get with John le Carré shortly before his death, actually. He had just published what is now his penultimate novel. They dug another one out of a dusty bottom drawer after his death, but this was for Agent Running in the Field. And David Cornwall, or John le Carré, as we all know him better, didn't really like giving interviews either to the newspaper or radio or TV. So when the opportunity came up to have a word with him, I leapt at the chance.
As with, I think, all of your previous books now, you narrated the audiobook version. Does that bring out the inner actor in you?
I've been recording with the same outfit now for a number of books, with the same technician, the same producer, and I really enjoy that. That's a few days of fun. Does it bring out the latent actor in me? I think it brings out the real writer in me. I really can't write unless I'm speaking my lines, correcting my lines according to how they hear to me. I read them aloud to myself, I read them aloud to my wife, poor lady, but she puts up with it. And I love the shaping of paragraphs and the shaping of sentences tonally, and actually to hit a point in the arrangement of monosyllables and how to end a sentence with a kick. All of those things are to me vocal. It's a kind of closet oratory that you get into. And I think that applies to many writers. And storytelling was born in the spoken word. Long before people wrote things down, they spoke their stories to one another. And I think it was Ford Madox Ford who said that I write in order to speak to a friend across the fire. I share that view. So the best compliment you can pay to a story, really, is to read it aloud or have it read aloud. I really believe that. That's not simply because I'm talking on this program. It's the truth.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself, then?
Yes, quite often, and I get sent them. It's an odd thing. There are some writers who really can't read their stuff very well, in my view, and there are others who are quite gifted and know how their stuff sounds before they read it. Then, occasionally, as with the last book, in fact, I didn't read it, and Tom Hollander, a wonderful actor, read it. And I listened to it the other day, and it's so perfect. You immediately enter into that cone where you identify with the personality of the voice. And that's how it should be. It should be bewitching.
A professional intelligence officer is no more immune to human feelings than the rest of mankind. What matters to him is the extent to which he is able to suppress them, whether in real time or, in my case, 50 years on. Until a couple of months ago, lying in bed at night in the remote farmstead in Brittany that is my home, listening to the honk of cattle and the bickering of hens, I resolutely fought off the accusing voices that from time to time attempted to disrupt my sleep. I was too young, I protested. I was too innocent, too naive, too junior. If you're looking for scalps, I told them, go to those grand masters of deception, George Smiley and his master, Control.
Tom Hollander reading from A Legacy of Spies by John le Carré. Available wherever you buy your audiobooks and from RNIB as TB24298.
You have a very good ear for dialogue and also dialect. Certainly in this book, I felt that Ed was authentically of the North, but well-travelled.
And kind of Londonised, urbanised too. But basically, he spoke this kind of cadence and with a slight indignation about him and thorough and straight into your face. That was my Ed from the start. And among all the refined voices that he is surrounded by, his voice stood out.
So you could hear his voice whilst you were writing the novel?
Absolutely. And, I mean, there were other characters too. The Russian character, the old spy, he goes to visit, Nat goes to visit. And I have been many times with Russians, and the Russians have a big heart, and frequently they have an expression in Russian. Yeah, he speaks beautifully, but he does not act so. And Arkady spoke like that. I know he did. The difficulty in such a case is to get the accent onto the page so that the reader, in his mind, hears it, even if he doesn't physically hear it.
As you have returned to your earlier work to make it into audiobooks, do you have a sinking sense that the world really hasn't changed a huge amount as far as people's suspicions of foreign countries, foreign governments are concerned, and also with Russia trying to destabilize the West?
Well, the first part of the question, has the world changed here? To my mind, far too little. I am quite radical in my perceptions about how the country should be run, what radical changes we should make. I would wish them to be made actually by a conservative government rather than a left-wing government, because then they don't look like resentful acts. I think it's high time we reduce the scale of the monarchy, put the queen on the bicycle, as we do in foreign countries, as foreign country to Scandinavia. I would like to see the end of the public school system, simply because it is quite wrong that 8% of the public should receive these exceptional forms of education, and that becomes immediately demonstrable in our elite. The definition of a good country is twofold. It's how it looks after its losers, and how it selects its elite. So far too little has changed for me. And the root cause is something I've witnessed at first hand, really, having taught at Eton and been familiar with the British establishment. The whole Brexit operation, for instance, is part of a long-standing Europhobia that nestled at the heart of the landed English countrymen. This is an English revolution, if you like, or counter-revolution that's going on, English nationalism at its worst. You know, they are the same people who gave us the Suez War and other really quite reprehensible acts. And deep down, it's a racist sentiment, and it's isolationist in the sense that the Brits, the English particularly, are the best people in the world, in their opinion. Nothing to touch them. It is now, to our shame, still the case that those people, called by, if you remember, by John Major, the bastards, but they go back a lot further than that. It's to our shame that these people are really having their will with us, with the combined effect of a huge propaganda movement, I know no other word for it, that's gone on for years in social media, through the fact that our tabloid newspapers almost exclusively belong to offshore oligarchs of the far right. And because there is a way of bullying the public vocally. We have, in Johnson, we have an Etonian street orator representing, if you can believe it, the man in the street with that education, that background, that elitist perception of himself. Oddly enough, Trump is up to the same game. And across Europe now, we see forms of autocracy developing and a resurgence of far-right feeling, which, curiously enough, in Eastern Europe, expresses itself in affection for the new Russia. So ask me how I see the world now at 88. I see it quite gloomily. We need to do so many things so fast. We need to redistribute wealth. We need to level the playing field by putting everybody in the same school, which is what happens in Germany or France or Spain, the neighbourhood school you go to, and you go through the system, and at least you meet the woodcutter and the carpenter and the grocer and the butcher and their sons. You can go through the English educational system now, if you're very rich, without ever meeting anybody who's gone without a meal. And that can't be right.
And then you can become Prime Minister.
And then you can become Prime Minister, exactly so. And Johnson himself, of course, was an early part of the Europhobic propaganda movement. When he was in Brussels, he invented a lot of fictions about how awful Brussels was and the bad things it was doing to us. And he actually lied to such an extent that he was thrown off one newspaper and quickly picked up by a newspaper now belonging to offshore oligarchs again.
A theme that really runs through your books is decency, something that Alec Lemus in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold calls a love of ordinary life, a respect for triviality.
It is really true. I think that has, having come from such a chaotic background myself, with my dad, this recurrent confidence trickster in and out of jail. My mother left me when I was 5, and I didn't see her again till I was 21, a completely unemotional encounter by then. I sort of scrabbled around in my early years trying to find for myself some kind of standard of life, some kind of social order that I respected. And it's very simple. I did come to the conclusion that I'm quite influenced by the Germans in this respect, funnily enough. They have their own word for it too, Anständigkeit, and it comes up all the time. It's the definition of a reasonable man or woman. And we all know, really, what the qualities are that belong to such a person. And we all know when somebody is breaking the rules of decency. So I want to believe that there is a kind of spirit level in most decent people. And the sadness is that we constantly are led by people who lack that quality.
John Le Carré on Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Now, Red, before you step away from the presenting chair, let's have the books of your life.
You know, I've been given some pretty hard tasks to do in my 6 years in the Read On chair, but actually this is the one that has kept me awake at night, partly because I think I might have done this right at the very beginning of my time, and I was racking my brains to see if any of the books were going to be the same, and partly because I just love books. It's such a difficult question to ask, but I will do my best. So, in the time-honoured fashion, will you ask me the first question?
Hang on, wait till I get my guitar. Red Seal, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Absolutely. I loved the Enid Blyton adventure books, The Valley of Adventure, The Castle of Adventure, and The Ship of Adventure. And that led me just to wanting to solve mysteries as a child. And then round about 11 years old, I picked up this book that my mum had left lying on her bedside table called Sleeping Murder. And I remember it just had this cover that made me want to open it and find out what was going to go on. And we just moved house to this slightly creepy and very isolated cottage in Sussex. And the old lady who'd vacated it had fairly much cursed us as she'd left. And this book was all about a young New Zealander who comes across to the south of England to look for a house where she and her husband are going to set up home. And she falls in love with this cottage on the south coast and moves in. And as she starts refurbishing the house and making improvements, she finds that everyone that she suggests reveals how the house used to be, and she gets these uncanny feelings that culminate in her being too scared to walk down the stairs. So a cousin of hers takes her for a night out in London where she meets Miss Marple. Well, as you know, if Miss Marple or Hercule Poirot appears in an Agatha Christie novel, there's going to be a murder sooner or later. And I guess it was my first introduction to a psychological mystery. And I went on to love the books of Barbara Vine and so on and so forth. And I think that book really just changed my 11-year-old life and probably made me the reader that I am today.
For a moment, Gwenda stared at Miss Marple and then she pushed back the hair from her forehead. "Why did I say that?" she said. "Why did I say Helen? I don't know any Helen." She dropped her hands with a gesture of despair. "You see," she said, "I'm mad. I imagine things. I go about seeing things that aren't there. First it was only wallpapers, but now it's dead bodies. So I'm getting worse." "Now don't rush to conclusions, my dear. Or else it's the house. The house is haunted, or bewitched or something. I see things that have happened there, or else I see things that are going to happen there, and that would be worse. Perhaps a woman called Helen is going to be murdered there. Only I don't see if it's the house that's haunted, why I should see these awful things when I'm away from it. So I think really it must be me that's going queer, and I'd better go and see a psychiatrist at once, this morning."
Andrew Timothy reading Sleeping Murder by Agatha Christie. Available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again?
Yeah, I absolutely love a collection of short stories by Louis de Bernier, who's better known for Captain Corelli's Mandolin, called Notwithstanding. Now, I have to confess, part of that is because Louis de Bernier was brought up just down the road from where I grew up. So it's a very familiar portrait of the Surrey-Sussex border and this little village called Notwithstanding, which is not really withstanding the changes that are happening around it. And it takes various of the village characters, the old general who is beginning to get dementia and keeps travelling into Godalming, having forgotten to put on his trousers, or the young lad who goes and fishes in the local lake trying to catch the great pike. They're just a charming set of stories that really conjure up village life in that part of England in the 1980s and 90s and just take me back to what was actually a very happy childhood.
Mrs. Griffiths goes to the shop and stands next to Obadiah Oak, her nose wrinkled in distaste. Obadiah, known to all as Jack, lives with his daughter by the cricket green in a cottage that has been handed down in his family for seven generations. Jack is the village's last peasant, and he and his house smell of 200 years of peasant life. He exudes the aromas of wet leather and horse manure, costive dogs, turnips, rainwater and cabbage water, sausages, verdigris, woollen socks, Leicester cheese, fish guts, fraying curtains, mice under the stairs, mud on the carpet and woodlice behind the pipes. But, most of all, he reeks of six decades of neglected hygiene. Jack is considered a character, with his teeth like tombstones, his stubble like a file card, his lips like kippers, his rolling Surrey accent, and his eyes as round as plates. But newcomers avoid him if they can.
David Thorpe reading from Notwithstanding, Stories from an English Village by Louis de Bernier. Available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
Yes, well, I'm going to do what my guests so often have done in the past and tell you about the book that I've just put to one side, which actually I think is a future classic and may well appear on this year's Booker shortlist. It's an author I've actually interviewed on the programme called Elif Shafak, who is a Turkish author who writes in both Turkish and she translates her own books into English. And this book is called The Island of Missing Trees, and it's set in Cyprus and also in London, and it's about a young Greek Cypriot called Kostas and the love of his life, a young girl from a Turkish Cypriot family, Daphne, And they meet in the early 1970s, just as the island is about to be torn apart by civil war. And it's about their love affair, which goes through many peaks and troughs. And part of the story is told through the eyes of a sentient tree, which might sound really strange, but it actually works. It gives a third-party perspective on the futility of human war and the beauty of human relationships and the nature that surrounds us as human beings. It made me laugh and it made me cry, and it did everything that a book should do, and it is absolutely brilliantly narrated.
Later, much later, when the worst had already happened and she was alone in her bed at night, unable to fall asleep, listening to her father, also sleepless, pacing the house, Ada Kazantzakis would revisit this moment, this fissure in time, when she could have done as she was told and returned to her seat, remaining more or less invisible to everyone in the classroom. Unnoticed, but also undisturbed. She could have kept things the way they had been, if only she could have stopped herself from doing what she did next.
The Island of Missing Trees by Elif Shafak is narrated by Daphne Kumar and Amira Ghazala. It's published by Penguin Books and is available from the RNIB library. And Redsail, author of The Blind Man of Hoy, blind trust, mountaineer, journalist and former presenter of Read On. Thank you so much.
Robert, it's been an absolute pleasure.
And that's it, Red. Oh, I don't want you, that's your last time in the Read On presenting chair. But as I say, then it's a comfort to as much myself as the rest of the listeners. You will be popping up now and again on the show, but...
Well, Robert, you definitely haven't heard the last of me, but thank you so much for getting me into this chair and for sharing Read On with me over the last 6 years. I've learnt an awful lot from you, and you've become a very, very good friend. And, well, I will miss you. I will miss the Read On listeners. And, well, farewell for the last time. And do remember to read on.
Yeah.
I know. Is that all right?
Or do you know? Yeah. Okay.